100 and 2000 UTC. Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan this Wednesday, August 9th, 2023. Eyewitnesses say scores of bodies are decomposing on the streets of Khartoum, prompting one doctor to warn of a disease catastrophe.
Unfortunately, the hospitals, the morgues, the schools, everything has been hit and destroyed to a large extent.
And analysts say reshuffling finance ministers will not solve South Sudan's economic woes.
Economic improvement means putting some of the economic tools in place, added by the political tools. And the political tools are the acceptance of the reforms.
We'll have these stories and more coming up next on South Sudan in Focus. Doctors are warning of a disease catastrophe in Sudan due to the mounting bodies in the streets of the capital Khartoum and Darfur. After nearly 4 months of fighting between the country's two military factions, the Sudanese Army and the Rapid Support Forces, eyewitnesses have told Save the Children staff they saw scores of decomposing bodies in the streets of the capital. Morgues are at the breaking point due to power outages, a lack of workers, and not enough space. Dr. Arif Noor, country director for Save the Children in Sudan, tells me that out of 89 hospitals in the capital and the states, 71 of those are out of service.
Because this conflict is taking place in the urban areas, in the city of Khartoum and in the Darfur region, right in the middle of the cities and towns, that's why the most of the casualties that we are seeing are civilians, including women and children. And that also means that the infrastructure has been severely hit, including the hospitals. Unfortunately, the hospitals, the morgues, the schools, everything has been hit and destroyed to a large extent. So this obviously has also affected the morgues because the morgues only have so much capacity. And that too, if they have all the facilities in order for them to operate properly.
How long has this been going on, though, with the bodies piling up in the streets and just left there to decompose?
Unfortunately, it started right at the beginning of the conflict. From the beginning of the conflict, it has been a real struggle in removing the bodies from the streets. And this has not been reported by one source or a couple of sources. This has been reported by everyone. I mean, our own team members, when they have tried to assist people in the areas which have been affected by the war, or when they were trying to flee the war-affected areas, they themselves saw a host of bodies littered across the streets, unfortunately. And there was no distinction between men and women, children, or the people belonging to different military groups, or the civilians. So the bodies are lying everywhere. And unfortunately, when this is the situation and you just add on top of it the lack of water supply in these areas, so this means that there is a very strong chance of spread of communicable diseases, including waterborne diseases that can be spread in such instances very, very easily. And that can cause further deterioration of not only the health status of the people living in those areas, but also the overall impact on the disease morbidity and mortality, because people do not have access to any health facilities.
Right. So when you not only are not cleaning up the bodies, when you have no running water, you have no power, that just compounds the problem of the risk potential for disease.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what we are seeing in these areas. And on top of it, beyond these dead bodies and beyond the risk of disease spread because of this, because of the lack of simple medicines, basic medicines, we are seeing cases of malaria, for example, remaining untreated, or the chronic illnesses, people living with diabetes or hypertension, for example, they are finding it difficult to access medicines and therefore are in a very, very difficult situation. And just a couple of days back, I was out in the field, and it was really heartbreaking to see young children, as young as one child was 1.5 years old. And that child suffered a burn injury because of the, a projectile that hit their house, and it caused fire, and the child's side of the face and part of his head and part of his arm was badly burned. And
you saw that child?
Yeah, of course, I was with the child. So we are now trying to help the child access better medical care. Similarly, I saw another child who unfortunately received, we don't really know exactly, but either shrapnel or pellets in their head because of a gunshot. And because there was no proper medical care was not available, those pellets or shrapnel have not been removed from his skull. And the child is suffering now from convulsions. He has healed, but he is not showing signs of brain damage.
That is Dr. Arif Noor. He is country director for Save the Children in Sudan. He was speaking to me today from Port Sudan. Some South Sudanese analysts are criticizing President Salva Kiir for his periodic sacking of finance ministers as an excuse for purportedly fixing the country's deep economic problems. He appointed at least 10 finance ministers since 2011. Analysts say Kiir should instead implement economic reforms defined in the 2018 peace agreement. They also say policymakers, including finance ministers, should be given enough time to execute their directives. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Late last week, President Kiir sacked his latest finance minister, Dier Tong Ngor, replacing him with Barnaba Bakchol, who holds a Bachelor of Science in Economics and a Master's of Business Administration from the universities of Juba and Buckingham, respectively. Since the establishment of the unity government in 2021, Kiir has appointed 5 finance ministers. South Sudan has had at least 10 finance ministers since its independence in 2011. Reja Gladi, a lecturer of economics at the University of Juba, says Juba's periodic sacking of finance ministers does not give ministers and other policymakers enough time to measure economic progress or failures. She says it also makes it difficult to evaluate the performance of the ministry.
At least if you could have one minister to stay in power for around 5 years so that we track the policy implementation and evaluate whether he has actually achieved his objectives of the nation or no.
Boboya James, a policy analyst at the Juba-based Institute of Social Policy and Research, agrees, saying Kiir does not give his ministers time to address the growing economic crisis in the country, adding that finance minister appointees tend to live in fear, knowing they could be fired at any time. He says the economy will turn around when the government follows the reforms laid out in the 2018 peace deal.
Economic improvement means putting some of the economic tools in place added by the political tools. And the political tools are the acceptance of the reforms. The peace agreement and the roadmap has articulated significant reforms issues, such as, you know, boosting other sectors, such as easing taxation internally, such as strengthening the local South Sudanese to be able to venture into significant private sector arrangements.
Gladys says the finance minister should zero in on certain areas.
Well, I would encourage the Ministry of Finance, you know, to focus more on the expansionary fiscal policies that include increase in public expenditure, you know, to finance some of the projects in the agriculture sector, the tourist sector, and other important sector of the economy. We have the, he should continue actually implementing the public finance management reforms.
Jamie says the problem of the country's worsening economic crisis is embedded in weak institutional governance and policy making.
There are cartels in town that made governance impossible in South Sudan because they used the government as a business entity. And they then brought an inner circle that confuses the president in making independent and well-informed decisions at some point. So long as the cartels that promote state capture in South Sudan continues to exist, then you see these issues continue to manifest.
South Sudan's economy has continued to deteriorate since the unity government was formed 3 years ago. Over the past 2 months, the South Sudanese pounds has depreciated against the U.S. dollars by around 35%. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Hundreds of civilians in the Bur Payam of Torit County in eastern Equatoria State are going hungry following a prolonged drought in that area. A South Sudan state lawmaker from Torit says people are surviving on wild fruits and tree leaves, which are scarce. The head of the State Relief and Rehabilitation Commission says the RRC has no more food to hand out, and there is a looming humanitarian disaster as several counties in the state move to worrying levels of food insecurity. Lucy Pony has more for VOA from Nairobi.
Eastern Equatoria State lawmaker Angelina Quinto, who represents Torit County, says prolonged drought in some parts of the county and flooding in others have affected crop yields, leaving many people hungry and thirsty at a time they would normally have plenty to eat. Quinto says prolonged drought has led to food insecurity as farm yields plummeted and seasonal rivers dried up. She says some people are on the verge of starving to death.
There is no rain. You know, there is a change of environment that area. This year is different. Both of already, really, they used to get a lot of the food and then water to not here to help them because from that water they will get the certain fish. They used to eat fish. But in this year, there is nothing like a fish, no rain. There is nothing grow well there. This is a problem. They don't have water. They don't have food.
Quinto says the local chiefs and representatives of youth and women's groups from Bur Payam visited her office last week demanding something be done.
They're eating some food, they aren't growing in the down like this. The people, they are suffering a lot. When yesterday I was just complaining, I said to those of humanitarian affairs, RRC, those of humanitarian, they received the complaint. Maybe they will send people to make assessment for that village.
Quinto says it is difficult to access parts of Bur Payam due to its remoteness. The head of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Eastern Equatoria State, Augustine Okuma, says most of the 8 counties of the state are food insecure due to prolonged droughts and floods. Okuma says a humanitarian disaster is looming with no food or water.
It is only Magu County that are advanced from level 2 to level 3. But the rest of the counties are advanced from level 3 to level 4. That is severe different food insecurity. Food insecurity does not mean necessarily famine. Famine is not at the extreme.
Okuma says some aid organizations like the World Food Program distributed food to parts of Ikotos County that were hard hit by the drought in the last 4 months, but admits that was not nearly enough to keep people alive. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. That church row in Bor between two religious leaders? Well, it hasn't gone away, especially after last weekend's incident. Find out more when we come back.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The primate of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan is urging the government to instruct authorities there to immediately reopen a Bor church closed by armed youths Inbor last weekend. Justin Badi Arama, who is also the Archbishop for the Diocese of Juba, accuses unnamed politicians from Bor of interfering with church affairs. Munyang David Mayar has the details for VOA from Juba.
Last weekend, a group of armed youth from Makwajpayam, who were allied to defrocked Archbishop Ruben Akudit, prevented hundreds of believers in the Jonglei state capital Bor from accessing the Langbar Beach Church for prayer services. At the time, Major General Elia Costa, the Jonglei State Police Commissioner, said security forces were deployed to maintain law and order and were vastly outnumbered by the armed youth and had to withdraw to avoid bloodshed. Addressing reporters in Juba today, Justin Badi Arama, primate of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan and Archbishop of the ECS Diocese of Juba, condemned last week's attack on the church and called on the government to intervene.
Today, in the name of the Almighty God, we call upon the government to immediately give orders for our church in Bor to be open for worship as soon as possible, and give freedom to all ECS bishops, clergy, and faithful move and operate freely in Bor town.
Acting Bor County Commissioner Paul Monquer says the local government does not have the capacity to reopen the Langbar B church.
It was closed by force. Where do I get a force that will go and open it? Let him talk to the president, to the governor. Then it will come down. It's not direct to me.
Repeated calls to Jonglei state government officials, including the deputy governor, went unanswered, and calls to Information Minister Michael McQuay and Cabinet Affairs Minister Elia Lomoro were not returned. Archbishop Badi blames state officials for failing to act and accuses some politicians from Bor of hijacking the church.
The church is non-tribal. If we take it along tribal lines, that is not a church. So the whole confusion is the communities who do not understand the difference between the church and the community affairs. So in church language, we say it needs continued discipling and teaching that they may understand.
Anguk Gordon Kwal, chairman for the Bor community, says the church and the community are one in the same.
The other day, did you not hear Badi talking about the election? Is it about God? Is it about Bible? They are politicians. So there's no way you separate the issues of community with the country, with the culture, with the law, with everything. They are interrelated in a way, because the same people who are politicians are the people who pray in the church.
Akurdit was defrocked by Archbishop Badi in August 2020 after he was charged for canonical disobedience, violations of the constitution, standing orders and laws of the church, as well as misleading and dividing Christians. This came after the then Archbishop Akurdit created three dioceses in his area and consecrated three bishops without approval from the other church leaders. Badi says, following mediation carried out by President Salva Kiir's office, Akurdit's defrocking has been lifted, and the bishop, who has reached retirement age, is now seen as a retired bishop in the Episcopal Church of South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
Several Libyan officials have stressed their opposition to the coup in Niger as they fear the military takeover could eventually impact Libya in particular. Some Libyan officials called on the 5x5 plus Joint Military Committee to address the situation in the border area with Niger and provide border security. Wolfgang Puchtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, explains to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi how the coup in Niger could destabilize the delicate UN-backed political process in Libya.
This could take place with regard to several areas. The first one is that the planned withdrawal of African mercenaries in Libya will be affected. There are still several thousand mercenaries from Niger in Libya serving with the LNA and other militias. Their withdrawal was agreed already at the Geneva ceasefire agreement in 2020 and again during a 5+5 joint military commission meeting in Cairo last spring. But now, after this coup in Niger, it's ever more unlikely that this will be implemented. In contrast to Sudan, where many of the Janjaweed mercenaries returned home to join the fight, the mercenaries from Niger will rather stay on in Libya as long as there is no major war at home, and the regime will certainly not encourage them to return home. Furthermore, the significance of Russian Wagner mercenaries, of the Libyan basis for Russian Wagner mercenaries, will increase further on. If they are engaged by Niger's new rulers, they need the bases in Libya as logistic bases, as stopover and refueling points for their supply flights for other Wagner contingents south of the Sahara, and now probably also in Niger. And this will make it ever more difficult to get Wagner out of Libya. Next one is, if, as a consequence of a failed ECOWAS intervention in Niger, a civil war breaks out, there would be certainly a spillover to Libya. The Fezzani Abla Suleiman are close relatives of President Bazoum's tribal group, the Diffa Arabs. The Tuareg and the Tubu tribal groups settle on both sides of the border, and in a civil war, all of them could get engaged. So if the situation in Niger is not stabilized anytime soon, we can expect real regional troubles, not only for Libya.
Some experts say Libya's border with Niger is almost entirely uncontrolled open space. The LNA troops closest to the border are based in an area over 300 kilometers north of the border. What does that mean for Libyan Sheikhi security?
Quite a lot, I would say. Containing migration and smuggling will have a low priority for the military regime in Niger. The intensity of surveillance of smuggling and migration, for the time being supported by the French, will certainly decrease. It can be assumed that the new regime will have no particular interest in stemming illegal migration or fighting smuggling. It is actually really possible that they will tacitly promote it in the light of the demographic developments in Niger. Therefore, a significant increase of smuggling activities and illegal immigration into Libya and further on to Europe can be expected. The LNA is fully aware of its soft belly in southern Fezzan and has reacted accordingly. They have deployed, additionally, about 4,200 troops to the 340-kilometer border with Niger. Well, that's a significant number, but by far too few to effectively monitor such a long border against human traffickers, smugglers, or an armed infiltration.
Terrorist groups such as the AQIM and the Islamic State use the vast and poor, very mountainous areas of Fezzan in southern Libya as a safe haven, logistics depot, training, deployment, and evasion area in which they can operate almost completely unchallenged. Could these terrorist groups exploit the fragile situation in Niger-Libyan borders in expanding their terrorist activities?
Yes, certainly. The pressure on the terrorist groups will decrease. Most of the successes of the Libyan National Army against the Islamic State and other groups in Fezzan were the result of intelligence-driven operations, and those were supported by the French and the Americans from their bases in Niger. So this pressure forced Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, Islamic State and the other gangs, terrorist gangs, to maintain a rather low profile. And without this foreign counterterrorism support, it will be much more difficult for the LNA to operate successfully. So an increase of activities of these terrorist organizations can be expected. Not necessarily only attacks in Libya, but an increase of weapons and fuel smuggling to the other countries in the region. Altogether, I would say that's very bad news for the wider regions if the terrorist safe haven in southern Libya cannot be contained anymore.
That is Wolfgang Puschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shanawi. A strike in Cape Town by minibus taxi operators, which is at the center of South African tourism, along with corresponding violence, has paralyzed tourism as well as essential services such as health and education in that city. South Africa's National Taxi Council declared a strike last week after municipal authorities impounded hundreds of taxis. Darren Taylor has this report from Johannesburg.
Cape Town is governed by the Democratic Alliance, a bitter rival of the ruling African National Congress. The ANC accuses the DA of being arrogant by refusing to negotiate with the Taxi Council. The DA says it won't talk with people it alleges are fomenting violence that's led to several deaths. ANC appointed Minister of Transport Sindisiwe Chikunga has demanded the immediate release of all impounded taxis. But Cape Town's DA Mayor Jordan Hill Lewis refuses, saying the vehicles were confiscated because they weren't licensed under the National Transport Act.
Every single taxi that we have impounded in the city is under that act, not under any new or malicious piece of legislation that we have brought in. So, frankly, it's a very surprising comment from the minister. It's her act, passed by her department, one that she is supposed to execute and see implemented across the country. So for her to abandon it in that way is very strange indeed.
As the political arguments and violence rage, tourism, the foundation of Cape Town's economy, is shut down. Thousands of international visitors have cancelled their August holiday trips to one of Africa's iconic cities.
Not long ago, Cape Town was named by a newspaper in the UK as the best city in the world. And we want to make sure that remains. We need to protect that reputation. It means jobs, it means economic impact, and we need to find each other.
Chifiwa Chivengwa is CEO of the South African Tourism Business Council. He says the killing of a British national in a shooting related to the taxi violence has made news around the world. And the United Kingdom is warning its citizens against travelling to South Africa.
It does cause a lot of reputational damage for any tourist in any country around the world who would die in this way, because it does make international news in terms of, you know, the number of murders that we may have in the country. So it's quite important that the situation that we have at hand is resolved for both South Africans to be able to go to work, those who work in the tourism industry, and for both tourists, be it domestic or international tourists.
Spokesperson for the Equal Education NGO, J.D. Seister, says the behavior of some in the taxi industry is unacceptable.
We found out on Monday the escalation of the strike meant that taxi drivers were going into schools and asking teachers to stop teaching and learning and demanding that learners be sent home.
Officials say Cape Town's calmer today, but many roads remain blocked. Taxis still aren't running, leaving workers, including essential staff such as nurses and teachers, stranded. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that will do it for us this Wednesday. Remember to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite radio and TV programs, as well as news updates. If somehow you missed this broadcast, head on over to voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Mama Sarah by Freedom Boys.
Beat your brothers, Maskey and Freedom Boys.
We've been listening to the song Mama Sarah by Freedom Boys. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Peter Hundley, the great engineer, Peter Hundley, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mama, bukora ita bisekiri muhabat, nina de, yeah.